Welcome to World Affairs, the weekly broadcast of the World Affairs Council. I'm Jane Wales, CEO. When it comes to countering terrorism or thwarting hackers, governments and companies can improve their strategies if they just think like the adversary. In this week's episode, we focus on that practice, known as red teaming, and how it can be used to pinpoint institutional weaknesses and anticipate potential dangers. In this hour, we'll hear from Micah Zenko, Senior Fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations. This event is recorded live in San Francisco before a World Affairs audience. And now to our moderator, Jonathan Tepperman. He's Managing Editor of Foreign Affairs Magazine.
Micah, you may know, is a Senior Fellow at the Center for Preventive Action, which is a center within the Council on Foreign Relations, which is the parent organization of Foreign Affairs Magazine, where I worked. He came to the Council from Harvard's Kennedy School of Government, the Brookings Institution, the Congressional Research Service, and the State Department's Office of Policy Planning. He writes the blog Politics, Power, and Preventive Action, which covers U.S. national security, international security, and conflict prevention, and is the author of Between Threats and War, and now Red Team, this great book that we're all here to talk about. So please join me in welcoming Micah, and we're going to jump into our conversation.
Thank you.
So Micah, as I've read this book, and I think it's fantastic. Everyone here, of course, will read it eventually, but I'm assuming they haven't yet tonight. So why don't you start by telling us, what is red teaming?
So red teaming is three things. I always like to describe it. It's a mindset of humility. That is a recognition that you work somewhere at a job where you cannot conceive of all the problems that your organization faces. The theme of the book is you cannot grade your own homework. And if you think of your own profession, you probably recognize that you work very closely with people. You probably think very similar to them. You probably have a boss that you're afraid to share your most dissenting and challenging views with because you think it's either going to be retaliated against or you think it's pointless. Subsequently, we have learned in lots of different organizational settings that people are the least likely to see blind spots in their strategies. They're the least likely to challenge the assumptions where they work, and they're really difficult to conceive of adversarial perspective. So once you accept the fact that you cannot grade your own homework, red teams is an approach to get around this institutional pathology that we all face. None of us can escape it, no matter where you work, especially at a bureaucracy that has any degree of hierarchy into it. So examples of red teams are, for example, if I'm the IT staff at a large corporation, I set up the computer network. It is very unlikely that I would conceive of all the ways that hackers, malicious hackers, can get into my computer network. I have a lot of concerns like functionality, ease of use, making sure I'm available when people download something, a PDF file they shouldn't, but I can't think like a hacker. And I shouldn't be trusted to assess the security of the networks that I set up. So what you do is you hire an outside red team. They look for all the vulnerabilities they can find. And they basically never fail to break into your computer networks. But the point isn't to embarrass or humiliate you. The point is to identify specific vulnerabilities and provide a set of recommendations that you can do to improve them. Another example that was in the news quite recently of a red team that did something like this was at TSA commercial airline checkpoints. The Department of Homeland Security Office of Inspector General has people who work there. They're just people who work at a desk job, auditors, and they ask them to try to smuggle banned explosives, knives, and guns through TSA checkpoints. And last year, at six different airports, they succeeded 60, out of 70 times, they succeeded 67 of them. Again, the point wasn't to show that the TSA has poor security. The point was to identify really glaring vulnerabilities, and subsequently, they have retrained everybody. There's a new leadership profile. They've changed the technology a little bit. And a final example of red teaming is what we call alternative analysis. So this is the one that's a little hard to get the fingertip feel for. But a good example of alternative analysis that I feature in my book is in the CIA, analysts all the time do what is called mainline authoritative analysis. Mainline analysis is what most people in the intelligence community do. It is to describe the world for policymakers as it is, with some degree of predictability of how it might turn out. The problem is that policymakers, whether in the White House, in the Pentagon, on Capitol Hill, they become really bored with this. As one White House official described it to me, it's like reading The Economist, but a little better. And over time, you want to see something different. You want the people that think outside of the box, that provide speculative positions that challenge the way we think of, they challenge the mainline analysis. So 2 days after 9/11, George Tenet, who was the director of the CIA, created something called the Red Cell. The Red Cell has been in business to this day. It consists of about 14 people. They work on whatever they want to work on. They don't have to coordinate their products with anybody. Nobody can tell them, you can't write that. And by design, they're incredibly weird and speculative. And I've interviewed a bunch of folks who absorb their content, and I say, why do you read it? What's the point of reading this if it's not reality? And they say, it stirs my mind. I wanted to have my opinions challenged. I wanted to have the opinions of a common, everyday intelligence community analyst be different. So those are three types of red teams that try to get around these constraints that we all face.
You do a great job in the book of telling the story of red teams, the history of red teams, starting with the Vatican and the office of the Devil's Advocate, which I hope we'll get back to in a second. But then you move into the military, and the military and the intelligence community, as you point out, are big advocates and users of red teaming. Just so we understand it, is this the same as war games, or are they something different?
So war gaming is a type of red teaming. There are three types of red teams that I feature in the book, because interestingly enough, although red teaming, the concept had been around for a long time, nobody had written a comprehensive book that provided both a definition, a structure, and a typology for thinking about it. So the three types that I look at are vulnerability probes. Again, these are the hackers. These are the people who are trying to smuggle things past TSA checkpoints. The second, as I mentioned, is alternative analysis. This is the CIA Red Cell. This is also examples like business wargaming, which we can talk about a little bit, that happens in the private sector. And then the final are what are called simulations. So simulations are before a scheduled event or a potential scenario you need to worry about, you think through every conceivable way that your plan or strategy could fail. So a great example of this that tests the system and that I go through in my book is the New York Police Department. The NYPD has what are called commissioner tabletop exercises. These take place in one police plaza on the 14th floor. I was very lucky to attend two of these, sort of rare as an outsider. And they have all of the commanders from the geographic areas. They have all of the city emergency response people. Mayor de Blasio attended one of the ones I went to, which featured the marathon. And what happens is they meet in a room, and they have no idea what to expect. And the chief of counterterrorism, a guy named James Waters, and one of his assistants, they read a script out loud, which is a series of disturbing terrorist-like scenarios. And then people are pressed on the spot to respond. So the marathon one was where you start the marathon in Staten Island above the Verrazano Narrow Bridge. What if a bunch of drones appear and you don't know where they're from and they look threatening? What if near Central Park where the race concludes, you see unattended bags that have the appearance of being explosives? What if someone calls in a bomb threat at mile 20, which is sort of up by Harlem? And what you learn is that people are pressed to respond with the capabilities they will have in that situation without having foreknowledge of the event. And it elicits an understanding of the situation that they could not find on their own. So that's a good example of red team simulations. But you're right, the military and the intelligence community is sort of where this generated. Red teams.
Tell us the history, if you will, starting with the sort of pre-modern history in the Vatican, and then its adoption by the military, and then take us up to the present and tell us how the business community got involved.
Sure. So I open the book with because people always talk about devil's advocates, and I started saying like, well, where does a devil's advocate come from? It's not a turn of phrase. It was an actual position that was created in the 13th century in the Catholic Church. For the first roughly 500 years of the existence of the Church, from like 250 to 750, basically anybody could become a saint, could be named a saint by local clergy. A local clerical authority, somebody who was a strong professor of the faith, could be named a saint. Now, the Vatican didn't like this because they wanted to control the process, and they didn't want sort of growth of localized saints because it took power away from them. So to centralize this over time, they created what was essentially a trial that if you wanted to be a saint, you had to have existence of two miracles. And there was a position created in the 13th century that was called the Advocatus Diaboli. And this was a person whose only job was to find every piece of horrible information they could about the saint candidate. And the trials would last for decades. People would come forth with greater proof that someone had committed a miracle, and the devil's advocate would go and find disconfirming evidence. Some of them lasted over a century. And subsequently, in 1982, Pope John Paul II basically eliminated this position.
Before you get there, did devil's advocates ever get in trouble?
Now, so the key thing is the devil's advocate could not be in trouble. They were tasked and trained and directed to find disconfirming evidence. So even if it was slanderous, libelous, whatever, they never got penalized for it. And it was a position authorized by the Pope himself. 1982, Pope John Paul does away with this and also reduces the number of confirmed miracles you have to perform. So if you know anything about this, basically, in the last 30 years, there's been more people made saints than had been in the previous 1,800 years. So people have described the Vatican in the last 30 years as a saint-making factory because this institutional check has been removed. So that's the pre-modern example, and that's sort of how the book opens. The concept really forms in the late 1950s and early 60s with Red being the Soviet Red Army. And it's people at like the Rand Corporation and the Pentagon under Secretary McNamara who are considering all the different ways that the Soviet Red Army will come into Western Europe through the Fold the Gap. They're thinking about things like arms control negotiating positions. How do we assume the role of the Soviet Union? How will they respond to a buildup in of our strategic missile systems? The first record I could find in public was in 1962. There's a political columnist who goes to the Pentagon and says, there's this fascinating game being played in the Pentagon backwards, where Robert McNamara calls his red team devil's advocates. And what the game that was being played was they had an outside team B of devil's advocates who were assessing the decision to buy this strategic bomber. And that's the first time that you see red teaming mentioned. Now, this continues throughout the Cold War, primarily in the military, for things like wargaming military operations and campaign plans, but also for big strategic decisions, also to, again, assume the role of the adversary that the U.S. military might face. But where it really kicks off again is as a direct result of 9/11 and the Iraq War. And so in the current military parlance, after 2003 and the Sunni insurgency sort of emerges in Iraq, the people who planned the ground war in Iraq created a school at Fort Leavenworth, Kansas called Red Team University. I've been lucky enough to go out there five or six times. I took the course.
How did you get such good access?
Persistence, bothering, you know, being a pain in the neck. It also has to do with, I sort of know, I mean, my background is writing a PhD in military operations, so I know a lot of people who do campaign planning, and they are nice once you know their language. And so they teach people how to essentially go to a command staff or a headquarters and be adversarial checks on military operations. Because one of the things we know is that military headquarters and campaign staffs in particular, they're extremely hierarchical. You sit next to each other for 16 hours a day. You care about mission performance and unit cohesion, and people in those positions simply do not challenge each other. They cannot conceive of all the ways a plan could fail because they're there as one of the guys who now teaches and runs Red Team University. He described it in 2003, no matter how many people told us things could go wrong in Iraq, we refuse to listen to our chain of command. We refuse to listen to the bad news. Instead, we listened to the chain of command because we were on mission lock. Our job was to take down Saddam Hussein. We didn't care about anything else. Now it has emerged more recently in the private sector. And so the two most prominent examples, which many of you all are familiar with in this community, I'm sure, is penetration testers who try to break into computer networks. Which is in the cybersecurity world is just a growing field. The attack surface of how hackers could break into the Internet of Things is growing exponentially, and subsequently, the vulnerabilities that are being found are growing exponentially. And one way you try to reduce those is to hire people to assume the role of the most likely adversary you'll face to identify vulnerabilities before the bad guys do. The second example in the private sector is what's called business wargaming. So this is where mergers and acquisition does a lot of this. Pharmaceutical industry does a lot of this. So if I'm a drug company and I have a big event coming up, like I have a drug going off patent, that's a big deal, right? And one of the things that they've learned is the people who are planning the drug going off patent cannot conceive of all the adversarial reactions. So they can't think about how the competitors will respond, how the distributors respond, the regulatory, their customers. And so what you do is you hire an outside person who knows your industry quite well and probably has had months to learn about your firm and your competing firms. And they come in and they make you assume the role of your adversaries. They literally dress you in the clothes of a competing CEO. They make you play the role of an FDA regulator. And they go through a series of what are called pre-mortem analyses, which is, again, thinking through every way this could fail, thinking through the worst possible outcomes. And they find things that on their own they couldn't find. And that's the big sort of insight of red teaming. Red teaming always achieves one thing, which is you learn something about yourself and about your strategies and your processes that on your own you could not know.
So I have a question that gets to your, on that point, that gets to your sort of your overarching thesis of the book that you can't grade your own homework. The point being, organizations are understandably but infamously bad at identifying their own vulnerabilities and also what they habitually get wrong.
Right.
So the question is, how do you know when you need a red team? Because isn't there a paradox there that the more likely you are to need a red team, the less likely you are to realize that you need a red team?
Yeah. There's a great University of Cornell psychologist, David Dunning, and he's done all these experiments where you give students and grad students pop quizzes, and the people who do the worst on the pop quiz think they do the best. So not only are they bad test takers, they're wildly overconfident, which is a horrible practice to be in. And I always tell people if you to just think about in your own life and the leaders and your bosses you have. Read the New York Times Corner Office series. It's the most fascinating thing, other than the vows, the marriage section in the New York Times, because the Corner Office series, they interview leaders in a range of different fields, and they all say three things over and over again. They say, my office door is always open, and I welcome people to dissent and challenge me all the time. Every boss says that. The second thing they say is, we have a horizontal organization. I want to empower my employees to make decisions, and they should, because they'll see things I can't. And then the final thing they'll say is, if something's really wrong, I'll know. Either one of my employees will identify it, or I'll know, or somebody will tell me. Somebody will tell me if something's wrong. It's a wildly overconfident position to take, but people who become leaders are wildly overconfident almost by self-selection. So how do you know when to do it? Well, the reason people decide to red team is there's either a big event in their industry, like a competing firm gets hacked and all their customer information finds its way onto the internet, or there's a regulatory requirement. This is also a big thing. If you use payment card information, a swipe card at your company, or you're a HIPAA regulator, you have to do security vulnerability assessments to identify. Or if you just, again, you have a big event coming up, you have some large strategic decision. And I'll just give you one example again from the book was in 2011. They thought Osama bin Laden was potentially in this compound in northwest Pakistan. The people who had been this small unit within the counterterrorism center at the CIA, who were really good at finding bad guys and killing them. In fact, the woman, her name is Maya, that's not a real name, but in the movie Zero Dark Thirty, she literally said it's a 99% likelihood he's there. The people around her, wildly overconfident. Now the problem is, because they're really good at finding bad guys, they thought they found the worst guy. And then they had another CIA team look at it, and they said it was like 75-80%. But you can't have the CIA red team its own counterterrorism unit. So then at the very last minute, and I'm sort of the first person to reveal the story because people talk to me, is they had three people who had no idea about that this was going on, who hadn't been read in on any of the intelligence. And Mike Leiter, who was the director of the National Counterterrorism Center, brought all three of them into a room. And he said, I want you to look at all this intelligence. You have 5 days. And you have to come back to me, and I want a probability estimate from you of how likely it is that bin Laden's there. And then you're going to come back to me, and you're going to tell me independently. because I don't want you to taint each other's answers. And the first person come back and says 75%, another says 60%, and then the person who had been following Al-Qaeda and Bin Laden the longest, he said 45%, right? And the reason for the divergence in reactions was people whose background was Iraq WMD were underconfident. People who were good at finding terrorists were overconfident. So that was a big event. And so they knew they needed to have this outside red team intelligence estimate for those sorts of things. But if you red team too much, red teaming can be demoralizing. It's painful. If you red team too much, all you're going to do is respond to it. And if you red team too little, you become hidebound and complacent, and you fall back to your typical mindset that your organization constrained you to absorb. So finding that balance is one of the tricks.
Well, your book is full of great stories and anecdotes and case studies, and some of them are not about red teams that worked, but red team exercises that failed. Tell us an anecdote about how an organization screwed up a red team, and what are the lessons that you can learn from that?
So the most painful one is the before 9/11, there was a red team in the FAA. It was called the FAA Red Team. It consisted of five or six people. It was led by a security expert who I actually was just in contact with today, named Bogdan Zakovic, who later became a federal whistleblower. And these five or six people, this red team had been formed after the Lockerbie bombing in 1988. Their job was to essentially assume the role of motivated terrorists. How would motivated terrorists try to take down commercial airliners? And they did all of these exercises like, they smuggled explosives past screeners all the time. And Bogdan would dress up as an employee of the local airport, and he would pretend to sit behind the screener to watch the packages go by, because he would get a notice on his cell phone, we just dropped them, and there would see some identifying tag. And he would see them go by all the time. And they did one at Hamburg, which was where the explosives that were used for Lockerbie, and it was like 47 out of 47 per times they got explosives past screeners. They would do other things to test security, like one of the guys would just walk onto a tarmac and see how close they could get to the plane, or see what he could do until someone stopped him. And it was interesting, like nobody was security aware or security conscious. And then sometimes people would come up to them and say, like, what are you doing here? And one of the people on the red team would say, oh, I'm here doing a security assessment. And they'd go, okay, go ahead, which is a violation of security protocols anywhere. And so this FAA red team found all these horrible vulnerabilities, and they told their bosses. Now, what their bosses could do with the information was to then go to the commercial airliner themselves, and they could write a letter of condemnation. Or they could impose a small fine, and then subsequently those fines would be negotiated down between the lawyers of the airline and the FAA. And their bosses, not surprisingly, were all former commercial airline executives. And just before 9/11, the number two official at the FAA, she had actually previously been the head of security at Logan International Airport. So they kept reporting all this bad news. They started going around their bosses to Congress, to key senators. They went to the media. You can still find it online. One of the more disturbing things is in June 2001, some former FAA employees, I'm sorry, this FAA red team, they do a security assessment for the local Fox team at Boston. And they smuggle knives through the terminal that the 9/11 hijackers used to get one of the planes. All of this was sent to people in the Government Accountability Office, to the key congressional committees, and no one did a thing. Now, 9/11 happens. Bogdan then compiles everything he had been sending people the whole time, and he becomes a federal whistleblower. He wins his case. The Office of Special Counsel determined that there had been a gross misuse of public funds that led to a specific harm of threat to citizens. And then they did away with the red team, because they didn't want these people thinking like terrorists in that sort of way. Bogdan, to this day, works for the TSA because they couldn't fire him because he's a whistleblower. He works from home, and he's essentially a well-paid desk clerk. And they don't take advantage of any of his...
Does that mean they're not doing any red teaming today?
So now, as I mentioned before, they do red teaming, but in some ways, it's more disturbing and less disturbing. So the way they do red teams now is they take the Department of Homeland Security Inspector General, literally takes people from their desks and says to them, try to smuggle things past these screeners. They don't get to surveil the target. They're not experts. They don't practice it. They just try. And they succeed a lot. Now, but the one thing they don't do is, what if I was a terrorist who really wanted to kill a lot of people? That's what the FAA red team used to do. That sort of most devious, most lethal, most malicious red teaming they don't want to have done anymore. It's also, Bogdan's team was very adversarial. They saw themselves as, we want to make everybody uncomfortable with what we do.
Which you write in the book is critical to successful red teaming.
It's critical. I mean, it's one thing to, you know, I also talk in the book about people who break into buildings for a living. It's one thing to go to the front door, see if the door's locked and walk away, or see if a window's unlocked. It's another thing to spend several months posing as somebody interested in a job and then getting access and then finding your way around the building, finding where the computer room is, stealing information, going in through the smoking door, social engineering your way to cause disaster, and causing the most pain that you can. That's what a real red teamer does. A real red teamer wants to make it as painful as possible for the organization. And that's not quite what they do anymore with commercial airline security.
So say you're President Obama, just to pick an example at random, and you're trying to decide, for example, whether the United States should increase its military engagement in Syria. Do you red team? And how do you go about doing it?
So interestingly, because it's one of the examples I talk in the book, is I say, if I'm the president, you should red team big decisions, right? You can't red team everything. It's expensive. It's painful. It takes a lot of personnel. But before President Obama, on September 10th, 2014, made the war speech where he announced his Syria strategy and sent the United States to war, that strategy had never been red teamed. I know that within the White House. They were...
What strategy? The bombing for chemical weapons?
No. This is the four lines of effort, the degrade and ultimately destroy.
Oh, the recent speech.
Yeah. So that was never red teamed by any outside group. So as I sort of, they basically had about 3 weeks to red team it, and they probably should have, and they didn't. Now, there's a quite interesting thing going on. I was actually asked by somebody in a government agency to come in and help them think through ISIS and Syria strategy. They said, we want to apply red teaming techniques to the ISIS strategy. And I sort of gave the overview of how you might do this and what the outcomes might be. And I said, get ready, because it's going to be painful. Because you're going to find information and you're going to come to a position that your bosses will find uncomfortable. And at the end of it, they decided, well, we can't do that. And the reason they can't do that is because the strategy is so clear. The White House is not interested in adjustment. Mm-hmm. So when the political bandwidth for making changes is very narrow, you really can't red team, because nobody wants to hear that sort of bad news.
So this is a great example of the principle that you talk about in the book, that the boss has to be committed and the boss has to be open to it.
Yeah, I mean, these sorts of books, as much as I wish I didn't have to, you have to have a chapter on best practices, right? And the first best practice I talk about for all red teams is the boss must buy in. If the senior leader doesn't care, whether it's a senior vice president, it's the chief information security officer, if it's a colonel of a brigade combat team, if the boss doesn't buy in and invest money, time, resources to the red team and signal to everyone down the chain of command that the red team matters, they won't get the access they need, they won't get the funding they need, and no one will listen to what they turn out. And lots of bosses, I was down in LA talking to people who do some of this in the private sector, they actively avoid red teams. And the reason is, if the red team finds something that's harmful and damaging, and then you get sued in the process of discovery, it's revealed, the penalties for negligence are smaller than due diligence. Smaller than willful harm. So they actively avoid hearing bad news. And when those sorts of situations happen, you need to worry. I'll just point out for people, if you really want to learn how this happened in a modern corporation and was very harmful, it's a freely available online. It's one of the most interesting cases of organizational failure you can find. After the GM ignition switch catastrophe came out, they hired a law firm to write a report to the GM board of directors. You can find it online. It's about a 200-page PDF file. It's a fascinating document, because what led to the deaths of over 140 people, hundreds of millions of dollars of penalties, the CEO lost their job, was culture. There was a cultural failure within General Motors. Basically, the most important priority that everyone was told over and over again was quarterly profits. Quarterly profits mattered more than anything else. And people were instructed to use very specific language when security and safety issues emerged. They were taught to minimize and diminish anything that people raised. They were also taught to, whenever a security issue came up, form a committee to study it, and then form a committee to look at that committee to see if it was right. So we'll see how it plays out. I don't think anybody will ever be found criminally negligible for the 140 people who died. But the issue was more the culture that the senior leaders promoted. Mm-hmm. They didn't want bad news to emerge because it would cut into quarterly profits. And everyone made clear that was the priority.
You're listening to World Affairs, a weekly broadcast of the World Affairs Council. I'm Jane Wales, CEO. We're hearing from Micah Zenko, senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations. He's in conversation with Jonathan Tepperman, managing editor of Foreign Affairs magazine. The event was recorded live in San Francisco before a World Affairs audience. The World Affairs Council is a nonprofit organization. We're dedicated to engaging the public in conversations that matter. You can visit us at worldaffairs.org. And now back to our conversation.
So let's stay on this subject of culture, but I want to start taking questions from the audience, and I have one that provides a good segue. The question is, where does the CIA find red cell members? Are they intelligence officers, or do they get them from outside? The reason it speaks to the culture question is because, as you write in the book, successful or effective red teamers need to know the institution, yeah. But they can't be of the institution. Similarly, if you're red teaming the ISIS terrorist threat against the United States, for example, can you do it effectively if you're not a Syrian or Iraqi-born jihadist? You grew up in the suburbs of Washington and you work in Langley.
So to answer the first question, the way they find members of the Red Cell, it's now a highly desirable job to be in, so they get way more applications. And the woman who runs it, I think she just left, but she had been there 6 years. And basically, you come from somewhere else in the intelligence community, you're a respected analyst, and you're probably somebody who thinks critically and divergently. And you go then to the Red Cell and you serve for 2 years. And then you go back to your own job, because nobody should be a red teamer forever. Basically, you're to be exposed to the techniques and the mindset and the humility that comes with it, and then you go back to your job. But the sorts of things that she looked for example, was she would ask them, they had to be really good writers. They had to be had a breadth of experience. One of the things she talked about is she liked people who had experienced massive failure. And the other thing was she would ask people, tell me five or six topics that you wanted to write on, but you didn't have the time to at your current job. And because people who didn't have a good response to that probably weren't going to be good red teamers anyway. And then the people that gave her a response and she didn't hire, she stole all the ideas. Anyway.
And you talk about them being weirdos. Good red teamers are weirdos.
The term I use is fearless skeptics with finesse. It has to be people who by nature are out of the box critical thinkers. It is people, you know, at every job, and I can certainly think in my own job, everybody has some people they know like, well, we have a maverick. I work with this person who's a maverick. They're not afraid to speak up. So we don't have any problem here. But one of the things I've sort of found in every organization I follow is, almost without exceptions, mavericks get hunted down and killed because they're a threat to the institution. They're a threat to unit cohesion. They're a threat to the performance. And mavericks get shunted away, or they get released, or people stop listening to them. What was the second half of your question?
Where do you find good red teamers who understand the culture of your adversary? It's easy, for example, if you're talking about hackers, because there's not much difference between white hat and black hat hackers. They're essentially same people on opposite sides of the law. Similarly, if you're talking about a drug company, as you were earlier, it's not hard to find people on the other side of a corporate challenge.
Right.
But when we're talking about terrorism, for example, how do you do it?
Well, so some people, though, I would say the white hat and black hat divide is bigger than you think, because some people can't act and think deviously and maliciously. They can't do it. At Leavenworth, one of the senior leaders there, when I was interviewing him, I go, what makes a good red teamer? He curled his tongue, curled in his tongue like a taco. And he said, can you do that? And I said, yes, I can. He goes, some people can't. Some people just can't do it. They have found in the U.S. military, for example, one of the things they do a lot of red teaming to look at base security. there are a lot of people in the U.S. military who cannot think about killing U.S. soldiers. And they ask them, what is every way that if I'm a if I have access to like mortar tubes and I'm the Taliban, or I want to get a car bomb close, how would I do this? There are a lot of people who can't do it. So some people just can't do, they can't think and act maliciously and deviously. But as when it comes to foreign threat sources, so I was asked recently, there's a group that's red teaming China's reaction to the U.S. pivot to Asia. And they described all the people that they were going to get. It was all these Mandarin and Cantonese speakers who had spent time in Shanghai and in China. I said, why would you have all China people? That doesn't make any sense to me. I mean, one of the things that constrains openness to new ideas is what's called the tyranny of expertise. Experts know their issue to the ground level. They know everything about it. But one of the things we know is experts are least likely to see wrinkles and discontinuities in their issue. One of the most famous examples of this was the smartest person on Iran in the CIA before 1980 had knew everything about Iran, was the most respected Iran analyst. Everybody went to this guy for what to say. He was the Iran expert in the United States. And he said the Shah would remain in power for 5 to 10 to 15 years because even though he knew everything about the political state of Iran, he didn't know much about these cassette tapes that were being traded around Shia fundamentalists in the Middle East and in Paris. They didn't read Ayatollah's comments. So I told these people running this China thing, I said, you can't just get all China experts or China people. I want people who know about rising great powers. I want historians. I want people who know comparative politics. I want people who know about transitions from agrarian to technologically advanced societies. I want people who know about authoritarian, brutal governments and what they do to stay in power. So, you know, if you believe that you can never assume the role of your adversary, which a lot of people say, a lot of people will say to me, you cannot think like the enemy. You can't imagine what it's like to be a member of ISIS. And I always say, like, if that's true, then at its furthest level, then there can't be anything like social science. There can't be anything like political science. There can be nothing of sociology. All we can know is ourselves, right? I mean, and I was at a conference at Texas A&M. It was on women in national security, and Gloria Steinem spoke on the panel after I spoke, which was very cool to see Gloria Steinem. And one of the things that the speaker introduced Gloria Steinem and said, so does anyone here not know who Gloria Steinem is? And one hand went up, and it was Gloria Steinem's. So I always think of that example, and I certainly think in my own life, like, I don't know how well I know myself. Mm-hmm. So, and if we have a society where all we do is try to interpret our own motivations and feelings, that's a pretty reductive life to live.
This is another question from the audience, and I can guess what your answer is going to be, but I want to ask it anyways. Does knowing your weakness, discovering it during red teaming, necessarily result in an organization or institution taking action to improve it?
So a lot of, again...
And, sorry, just if I may, the example that the questioner uses is, we all now know that our records online can be easily hacked, yet few of us have taken the steps necessary to protect ourselves, because it's a pain.
I was at the, I go to a lot of security conferences, and one of the people who does like encryption and protecting digital records, he said, the surest way to assure that nobody gets access to your digital information is to never create it. That's the only way you can assure it'll never be created. Now, it's about trade-offs of risks and functionality and ease of use. If you wanted to protect all your records, you would write them down and put them in a safe and have people surround it with guns. But that wouldn't be a very effective way to do things. So we have all agreed that we are going to assume some degree of risk to losing our personally identifiable information in order to have an easier life. So I would say the least you should do, which everybody should do, is there are a series of best practices. You can find them online. The Department of Homeland Security publishes them. Actually, the Directorate of National Intelligence publishes them. Like, there are simple things that we all should do, because if I'm a low-grade hacker, I will go, when I see even best practice defenses up, I will go somewhere else. All they're looking for is the easiest, weakest point to break in. So everybody, there are certain things that everybody should do. And if you decide not to, then you've made you've decided to assume an even greater degree of risk. Mm-hmm. So yes, we could all be nearly perfectly secure, but that's not a life we want to live anymore.
Is private TSA more effective than government TSA? Let me put the question slightly differently. Did you find that the private sector is better or worse than government at red teaming?
That's a great question. It's hard to know because one of the more interesting insights, which I didn't expect to come to in doing this book, is The private sector is far more secretive than the CIA or the intelligence community the military. The private sector, because they have non-disclosure agreements, everything is proprietary information. Especially law firms, which are the holders of all corporations, are the most secretive of all because of attorney-client privilege. It is very difficult to know how well the private sector does at anything. Similarly, consultants and businesses themselves have every reason to lie. They have every reason to misrepresent how effective they are at whatever service or process they provide. And if I'm a corporation and I have vulnerabilities, I have every reason to hide them. So you see some of the same manipulation in the private sector that you do in the public sector. For example, every other year, if you're an owner of a plutonium reactor, a civilian plutonium reactor, you have to have an outside group try to break in, a multiple team, heavily armed group try to break in and get access to the plutonium or to cause damage or environmental harm. Basically, all of these are guarded now by private sector folks. And they do some of these exercises. You can read about them in government accountability reports. And it's quite fascinating because you find examples where it's like they were like laser tag sensors. You shoot them, the sensor goes off, and you'll see people, they'll rub mud over them, or they'll disconnect the battery so they can't get shot. Or they might know somebody on the team that's going to break in because they're all mostly former military, Marines in particular, and they'll get a tip off ahead of time. And then the security architecture is false. And they look, we did a good job. We defended against this, but it was not a realistic assessment. So I've never seen anybody do that, and it would be difficult. I don't even know how you do it.
Question on DARPA's narrative role-playing scenarios, which are designed to immerse soldiers in realistic battlefield conditions for Iraq, for example. Mm-hmm. Do they work? Is that effective? And is that red teaming?
It can be a type of red teaming if you have people who are authentically and realistically playing the role of the adversary. So there are some of these at Fort Irwin. The Air Force is famous for their red flag exercises where, for example, the Air Force might have stolen a couple MiG fighter jets from other countries and they test U.S. F-18 and F-16 pilots against them. The people who do these, the people who play the enemy, they're called the Op 4 or the Opposition Force. They are given free rein to be pretty brutal and pretty harmful. So I've never heard of that example specifically, but the people who do it before they are then deployed into a combat situation, I think are much better off for having gone through the simulations.
And do you feel that the conventional wisdom has swung so far in favor of red teaming in the military now, for example, that you don't need to make the case anymore, it's gospel?
No. So red teaming, whether it's in the private sector or the public sector, is never a core practice. It is not a core business practice. It doesn't generate income. It is always impossible to prove that. It's very difficult to prove that red teaming was necessary. So red teaming, as I mentioned, emerged as a result of not being adequately prepared for the Iraq operation to take down Saddam Hussein. As that event fades from people's memory, there's been less willingness to support and fund the billets for the people who go there to get trained. There's also the issue of a drawdown defense budgets are basically flat right now, and things like training and doctrine and education tend to get cut pretty quickly. So it's a harder case to make. There's also institutional resistance. And one of the case studies in my book is in 2010, the Commandant of the Marine Corps basically said, I want to train all these people in red teaming, and then they're going to be sent with MEFs or MEBs, which are units of 3,000 to 5,000 people, Marines who are deployed abroad, and they're going to act as the devil's advocates on the planning staff. And the commandant basically found out that nobody listened to him. The Marine Corps, a lot of senior Marine leaders said, we're Marines. Like, by definition, we think differently and outside of the box. We don't need to have someone doing it for us. Like, again, it's the belief that they could red team themselves. Like, we could grade our own homework. And they resisted and resisted and resisted him all the way. And subsequently, it's basically on life support to this day within the Corps. I don't know if it will emerge and have the standing it will. So in the absence of an event that is catastrophic and causes pain, there is every reason to do with these sort of preventative, prepared measures. Until there's a catastrophe like 9/11 or Iraq WMD or not being planned for the military campaign against Saddam Hussein, there's not that vivid, specific, real event to change people's minds.
So you think it's a lesson that we need to keep relearning?
Well, the point is to do it before the event happens. You know,
But aren't you suggesting that the need for red teaming is something that becomes very obvious after a catastrophic event, but then the urgency dissipates?
Yeah, and one of my favorite quotes in the book is the guy who was the head of security, Dan Irwin at Dow Chemical. He said the surest way to get senior leaders interested in a disaster management plan is to burn down the building across the street. The problem is you rarely have a spare building to burn down. So you have to do things to make it vivid and real and painful. And red teamers have lots of tricks and techniques to do this. But unless it's a real event that causes real pain, financial, reputational, physical, lethal, it's hard to do.
Are there limits to red teaming? This is another question from an audience member. So for what this person suggests is, it's easy to see how red teaming could be used against ISIS in tactically, but what about combating the ideology behind ISIS?
Oh, yeah. I mean, red teaming is particularly useful for persistent policy challenges. It's not just security or military related. I've been asked to help red team nonprofit funders, because people who fund nonprofits are frustrated with what they're doing. They fund the same groups. They can't see the impact. One of the other great cases in my book is red teaming polio eradication. So one of the heroes of my book is a woman. She's in charge of polio eradication for the entire U.S. government. Her name is Ellen Ogden. I saw her just 2 weeks ago, and she's this wonderful, driven, passionate woman. She works at USAID. And she became aware of red teaming through a colleague who worked at Fort Leavenworth, where they teach red teaming. She then met with people at Leavenworth, these two retired Army colonels, and said, we need to expose polio eradication to red teaming. Because if you know anything about polio eradication, basically 25 years ago, it was at like, there were hundreds of thousands of new cases a year, and then it collapsed from hundreds of thousands to 1,000 in the course of like 12 years. But it stuck at that level. I mean, now we're under 100. But basically what they found out was what got you from hundreds of thousands to 1,000 is what they just kept doing. But that's not what's going to get you to zero. But they just kept doing the same things for 10, 12, 15 years. And so she got these two retired Army colonels to go to Seattle at an annual Gates Foundation meeting. They made all the participants from WHO, Rotary International, Gates, all these global public health people, they went through a two-day red teaming exercise where they unpacked, examined, challenged every assumption that they had. And I was just in Seattle 2 days ago, and people who were there like still remember the event. It was in 2010. Like they still, like they thought about polio eradication in a way that they hadn't considered it before. So it's applicable to things that appear to be stuck policy challenges, and there's certainly nothing more stuck than counterterrorist messaging.
Right. This is, I think, a very good question. It sounds like
they've all been good questions.
This is an especially good question. It sounds like, by the way, that was good from the man who wants to sell books at the end of the night. It sounds like red teaming requires a knowledge of threats that are out there, that you have to appreciate the threats. How can you red team effectively in an unpredictable world where you don't know the threats?
I mean, I don't know if that's true. I mean, there's no such thing as, there's no, I would say, signature-free threat environment. Threats come in certain groupings, certain typologies. Even ISIS, there's a great report George Washington University scholars put out last week, which I invite people to read. It's free. They looked at every single uncovered ISIS-affiliated, directed, or related plot, and they identified something like 91 individuals living in the United States who were engaged in some sort of ISIS plot. Of those 91 individuals, like 90% were male. 79% of them were citizens. Most of the rest were on legal permanent resident basis. Most of them had some similar backgrounds, similar access to social media, a slight diversity in economic situation in life. But it's not like 310 million people. You could actually narrow it down specifically. So what you're trying to do is narrow down the most likely threats. You're not trying to look at every conceivable threat, because you have to prioritize what you do. Anybody who says, I'm going to protect you against everything, is lying to you. Their job is to protect you against the things that are the most likely to harm you and will cause the greatest damage. So it's trying to gather as much information as you can and assume the role of what is the motivations and capabilities of this adversary. It's not impossible, but it's extremely, extremely difficult for individuals who have a low signature, who don't communicate electronically, obviously, who don't appear to be that much different from lots of other citizens, it becomes much, much harder to do.
On this note, on the subject of unpredictable threats, I promised my son would ask, do you know if anybody out there is red teaming for a zombie pandemic, and should we be doing it?
Oh, yeah, good. I'm sure. I mean, global public health lends itself to a lot of red teaming because, I mean, you talk to global public health experts, they'll just say, this could happen and it could lead to 200 million people dying, and they're not lying, right? So they think about this, they think about how to quarantine, how to respond, what's the command and control relationship, what do all these different actors need to do? But zombies, I don't know, that's a tough one. But we know how to kill zombies.
That's right. Have there been cases where red teamers have leaked the information they've discovered? And is that a big risk for institutions considering a red team?
Yeah, so the FAA red team that I mentioned, they willingly leaked information. They went to their bosses, and then they went to the secretary of the Department of Transportation, and then they just started going to the media, and they went to other people. So that can happen. But there's a, I would say there's a responsible disclosure aspect to it, especially in the hacking world. So a motivated hacker who is proficient and knows some malware and knows how to get into systems can get into just about anything. I think of like probably the best hacker in the world is a guy named Charlie Miller. He's the guy who hacked the first two iPhones at DEF CON, the security conference in Vegas this year. He's the guy who hacked the Jeep. He can basically, from a distance with an iPhone, take over a Jeep and crash into the side of the road. Now, he had to have access to a Jeep. He's really good. He used to work for the NSA. He has a PhD in mathematics. But guys like him and lots less like him who have nothing but time on their hands, they find vulnerabilities. Now, what do they then do with that vulnerability that they found that the manufacturer or the company doesn't know? So they have several choices. They can go to the black market and sell it to criminals. They can go to a defense contractor who can buy it, and then they'll probably sell it to the NSA. They can go to the company themselves and blackmail them. They can go to the company in a responsible manner and say, I found a vulnerability. I'm going to give you 6 months to patch it, and then I'm going to go to the security conference and brag about the hack that I did. They can go to the Department of Homeland Security, which has a database, a clearinghouse of people who find hacks. But it all depends on what your motivations are. And it's actually what's becoming in the cyber world is more and more hacks are becoming hidden because the value is so great. I don't know if you saw it just about a week ago, somebody offered a $1 million bug bounty to hack the operating system for the, it's operating system 7 for the latest Apple, for the iPhone. And he offered $1 million, and somebody with a series of screenshots demonstrated that vulnerability, and they demonstrated it on a phone in front of this guy. So the guy bought it for $1 million. And he still hasn't decided what he's going to do. He could sell it back to Apple for tens of millions of dollars. He could give it to the NSA, who could then have access to everyone's phone. If Apple thinks it's encrypted, he could sell it to the Chinese for even more, right? So, and he would be legally able to do so because it's not illegal to do that under U.S. law. So this issue of disclosure is one that red teamers who are responsible think a lot, but not all red teamers are responsible.
And is there room for private individuals to act as amateur red teamers? And does the U.S. government reward them in various capacities, whether it's cyber or other?
Or
are you going to end up in jail?
So you can end up in jail, and if you find vulnerabilities in a computer network, you can end up in jail. Now, I always tell people, if you know anything about what Steve Jobs and Wozniak and those guys did in San Francisco, those guys today would have been in jail for 20 years. They basically got access to critical infrastructure. They stole hundreds of thousands of dollars of time and money on bandwidth. If those same guys lived today, they would all have spent a long time in jail and we wouldn't have Apple. It's true of a lot of sort of 70s and 80s hackers. So there's this concern that there's certain bills in front of Congress that is chilling security research, because if I'm a manufacturer, I might not want to know about these vulnerabilities. And if someone comes to me with them, again, I think they're trying to blackmail me because they say, I found this vulnerability. Do you want to know about it? And they say, okay, tell me. And they go, well, let's have a conversation about compensation. And then immediately they will interpret it as a blackmail situation. There are also news crews, TV news crews do lots of red teaming. And I have a really horrific example I have in the book of this local St. Louis news crew that wanted to see, were elementary schools safe from people coming in with guns? Now, you can imagine they didn't tell the principal or the security of the schools ahead of time what they were doing. They just wandered around to see what they could do. Somebody said there's somebody with a gun. The parents got panicked. They sent everyone home. It was really irresponsible. So what you should do is tell the people ahead of time who are in charge of security, who can know about it, what you're attempting to do. They'll probably say, if you walk on our ground, we're going to arrest you. But there are people who do it all the time. I mean, and there are people.
And the news crews, for example, who have smuggled weapons through TSA screening. Yeah. What's happened to them?
They're not charged because they say they're doing journalism, and it's their First Amendment right to reveal vulnerabilities. There are other people who say all the time that you're providing terrorists with a playbook. You are showing them how to commit devious and malicious acts.
Is there something to that?
There is. I mean, there are lots and lots but it's almost to the point now where terrorists have so many playbooks. You can go to, Dabiq, which is the ISIS's English language PDF file. They put it out every few months. You can read them. The bomb that took down the plane that left from Sharm el-Sheikh, the Russian plane, they posted a picture of it. I mean, it's really rudimentary, really easy to do. So at this point, there's so much terrorist playbook out there. What the journalists would say that unless we do the event and we broadcast it, you won't care enough to do anything about it, right? So it's a very tricky balance, and some people do it very irresponsibly, and some are doing it with the best intention and reveal what they do in a way that doesn't reveal everything they know but still makes people aware of a vulnerability.
We're almost out of time, so let me ask you one last question, and that's what you as an individual have learned in the process of writing this book about red teaming, and what we as individuals can take away from this conversation and from the book once we've all bought it and read it about the applicability of the mindset behind red teaming towards, we all obviously are members of institutions, but I'm talking about how we conduct ourselves as individuals.
So I was completely changed in the course of writing this in ways that I didn't imagine and wasn't even prepared for. I've become a much more humble, there's much greater humility in my work, in how I behave and how I act. I'm described often unironically as a national security expert, and now I have to use the air quotes when I say it because I'm now so conscious of how much I don't know. I'm also much more likely to very clearly and easily understand the vulnerabilities and strategies. It sort of elevates your level of looking at the world. You look at it a lot more strategically, you see problems, you're much more willing to challenge assumptions. I've always been someone who's kind of not afraid to speak up at work and in my profession, but I sort of am doing that at a higher level. I would invite you, one, buy the book. But if you don't buy the book, there's a great resource which is free online that the U.S. Army puts out, where this is what they give to their majors and lieutenant colonels who are going to become red teamers. It's called the Applied Critical Thinking Handbook. You can Google it. It's a PDF file. I think they're up to volume 7. And it's a good sort of taste. It's a good sort of feel. It's a very narrow way to look at red teaming, but it's sort of what they use. And I guarantee that if you read the book, if you read the Applied Critical Thinking Handbook, you will come away from it a different person. You will be much more skeptical of people like me wearing a suit telling you something you think is true, or generals in uniform standing behind podiums, or CEOs or people in the executive suite thinking that they know what they know, because I now know, having studied their organizations at an intimate level, that they don't know themselves and they don't know their organizations, they don't know what's wrong, and neither should you. Believe them.
The man is Mike Ezenko. The book is Red Team. Please join me in thanking him and thanking all of you for coming and for your excellent questions.
Great.
Well done.
You've been listening to World Affairs, the weekly broadcast of the World Affairs Council. We're a nonprofit organization, and we're dedicated to engaging the public in conversations that matter. Featured in this episode were Mike Ezenko, Senior Fellow of the Council on Foreign Relations, and Jonathan Tepperman, Managing Editor of Foreign Affairs. This broadcast is made possible weekly by the generous support of Chevron. Additional funding for post-production is provided by Maria Starr. She's a member of the KQED Producer Circle. Our recording engineer is Jim Bennett. Our technical supervisor is Monte Carlos. World Affairs is produced in association with KQED Public Radio. I'm Jane Wales. Thank you for joining us.